from Mississippi to New York, Colorado to West Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, across the nation, teachers are resigning their union memberships in record numbers. We find out why from Jason Dudash of the Oregon Freedom Foundation. Republicans are set to take control of the U.S. House of Representatives, creating an entirely new political climate in the nation's capital. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. As if childcare and the cost of commuting to work isn't expensive enough, government policies are contributing to the cost. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Scott Lincecum of the Cato Institute. And tax reform made headway in a number of states during 2022. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In Oregon, teachers are resigning their union memberships in record numbers, triggering what the union itself refers to as a crisis. There are reasons why teachers are leaving unions not only in Oregon but across the country. Here to discuss those reasons is Jason Dudash. Jason is director of the Oregon Freedom Foundation. Jason, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jason, as with every state, or virtually every state, Oregon has its own education association, a teacher union, if you will. What is the current status of the Oregon Education Association, particularly when it comes to the number of members in that association?
I'll tell you one thing, is they've certainly seen better days. Since Janus in 2018, the Oregon Education Association has now lost over 20% of their membership. In an internal document that was sent to us by a friendly teacher, they outlined their exact membership numbers since the Janus decision. And another thing that they decided to add in there was a little sentence where they describe what they're experiencing as a membership crisis. And I can understand why the union may think that this sounds like a crisis, but you know, for us and the rest of the teachers that are actually leaving the union, this seems much more like an early Christmas present.
Let's talk a little bit about why teachers would be leaving the union. These teacher unions in each state have been very, very strong, as has the National Education Association, very strong politically and otherwise. What is it that, aside from the fact they now can leave, is compelling these members to leave? Are they not seeing any value to their membership?
That certainly, I think, would be the best way to sum it up. Another thing is just how partisan these major government unions have become, not the least of which is the teachers union. I don't think there's an American out there right now that can see Randy Weingarten's face on TV without cringing, because we know everything that she represents. And what she does not represent is the interests of teachers, and certainly not the interests of students. That is something that has become painfully clear over the last 2 years. Here in Oregon and nationally, you're talking about an organization that is, while they state their stated priority is representing teachers, their finances tell a much different story. The National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers union, the parent union of the Oregon Education Association, they collected over $377 million out of teachers' paychecks in the year 2021. And I'm going to go ahead and tell your audience just what percentage of that was spent on anything remotely connected to representational activity or can be traced back to the classroom. Again, the union's own stated priority. That number is just 8%. 8%, just $32 million. Over half of their budget, over 55%, was spent on their own pet political projects. And when you take that data point to a teacher, and you say, hey, why are your textbooks still out of date? Why are you guys still struggling so badly with overcrowded classrooms? All these very real issues that teachers are facing with day in and day out for decades, and they are seeing that the idea that this multi-million-dollar organization that is supposed to represent and help them with those issues is nothing but a facade and is only stealing their money to advance their own political agenda. And that's quite a problem. I think that these last 2 years really highlighted that for a lot of teachers, and that's why we're seeing teachers now leave the unions at such a dramatic rate.
Is this a case of, during the COVID pandemic, teachers, as well as parents and students, had an opportunity to see what was happening a lot more clearly?
Absolutely. That's absolutely a part of it. And absolutely another big part of it is that teachers want to teach. That's, I think, overwhelmingly the sense. And especially when you're talking about lockdowns, which now we know are tied directly to this very alarming spike we're seeing in adolescent depression and suicide caused by these lockdowns that were being directly advocated for by teacher union leaders like Randy Weingarten. Teachers are looking at that and seeing that they don't want to be a part of an organization that is actively promoting policies that are harming the students in the profession that they love.
Have you also seen, and do you think teachers are also seeing, Jason, an increase in concern over what it is they're being required to teach, particularly when it comes to controversial areas such as critical race theory?
Yes, that is absolutely true. I think that a lot, the overwhelming sense is that those kinds of things are not meant for the classroom. You know, it wasn't that long ago where that was a pretty well accepted idea, that politics wasn't meant in classroom, and this radical sex education is certainly not meant for kindergartners. That's something that most Americans and certainly most teachers agree upon, and yet its only driving force is these major teachers' unions.
The unions will argue, conversely here, Jason, that they are providing very valuable services to their teachers, particularly negotiating new contracts, new labor union contracts. Are they now not really being able to make the case that what they're providing is worth the amount of dues that individual teachers are paying to them?
Well, it's absolutely not, because if it was, they want to have spent over half of their budget on other things. I think that is quite literally the definition of an overcharge. But the other thing that here is that now, thanks to Janus giving people the option to leave the union, the market was able to reinsert itself into the equation. So the teachers unions for years have really held teachers hostage using a lot of fearful tactics, and a few instances in particular of, we'll say, their liability insurance policy, where the NEA offers a $1 million liability insurance policy that is considered a member-only benefit, meaning if teachers opt out, that is something that they will use. And obviously that policy exists to protect teachers in an instance where maybe the student says that they hit them and the parents of that student decide to come after the teacher personally. That policy exists to protect them. That is the only thing that teachers lose if they opt out. Now, there are several teachers associations across America that offer much better liability insurance policies, as well as other things that teachers actually benefit from, and their dues are much cheaper.
We have been talking with Jason Dudash, who is Oregon Director of Freedom Foundation. And Jason, tell us a little bit about Freedom Foundation. Also, where can folks go to find you on the web?
The Freedom Foundation is pretty simple. We work every day to help public employees leave government unions. We see the government unions as the single driving force of most of what is not good in the country at the moment. And now it's really important for public employees to know that they have the option about union dues and membership. If public employees would like to look more into that, they can come visit us at optouttoday.com. If you're more interested in learning about everything we have going on at the Freedom Foundation, you can come see us and support us at freedomfoundation.com.
Jason Dudash of Oregon Freedom Foundation. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, it is a new year, and we have a new Congress about to take office. We're going to talk about that today with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. Great to be back.
Speaking of New Year's, there's going to be a new sheriff in town, a new majority in the House of Representatives as Republicans take control of the chamber. What sort of changes are we expecting to see?
Well, they're going to have a battle royale on the House floor to determine whether or not Kevin McCarthy is going to be the Speaker of the House. It should be pretty interesting to watch. That'll take place on January 3rd when the House convenes for the 118th Congress. This could go several ballots. It could be resolved. We'll see. It's going to be something that I think everybody's going to want to tune in to C-SPAN and watch, because it certainly will be a historic time. Well, we know that the House Republicans have a few-seat majority. I believe it's five seats right now. and the House is almost at full strength. There are 434 members of the House following the death of one of the members at the end of 2022. That being said, we know that the Senate didn't turn out the way that we wanted it to in November, and we went from a 50-50 Senate to actually Democrats having a firm majority at 51-49. So that means that the committee ratios will continue to bend in the favor of the Democrats. It means that they'll be able to move their legislation a little bit more efficiently. Same thing with their nominations. And the opportunities that we've got in 2023, I think, are really highlighted by that new House majority and how they're going to do investigations on the Biden administration and also all the crazy stuff that Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrat majority operated in 2022 and 2021. We also think that this is a real opportunity to defund some of the executive orders and executive actions from the Biden administration that are unconstitutional and are not conforming with federal statute or law. And so I think that that'll be something that you see a lot of the new Republicans really dig their fingers into and try to cook up a new recipe of federal oversight and investigatory work.
President Joe Biden, of course, has benefited from having unified government the first 2 years of his term, Scott, although it was difficult on occasion for him to keep everyone in line, particularly in the Senate, where Joe Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema often were at odds with the Biden agenda. Now the president has to deal with a divided Congress. So what does a Republican majority in the House do to President Biden's ability to further enact his agenda?
Hopefully it slows everything down, first of all, because we've seen with federal spending, we've seen with the Inflation Reduction Act, which obviously didn't reduce inflation, and we've seen with the Biden stimulus, and we've seen with nominations, just how quickly Democrats can get things done through the unified government. And so this Republican majority in the House is going to serve as a firewall against a lot of the things that the Biden administration would otherwise do very quickly. I think you'll see a lot of legal challenges, basically federal lawsuits challenging executive orders that are promulgated by the Biden administration. And that's a real opportunity for the courts to adjudicate whether or not these things that Biden's been doing are actually constitutional or permitted by law.
Looking ahead, as you mentioned, the Republican nominee for president is going to be setting a large part of the agenda here going forward, especially once we've identified who that individual will be. But we, of course, have elections once again every 2 years, the whole House of Representatives, and we have a third of the U.S. Senate up in 2024, Scott.
Yeah.
Is this an advantage for Republicans electorally in the Senate in 2024?
I hope so. Well, first of all, it means that there are more seats that we can prioritize to try to win and to win back a Senate majority. We know that money in politics is one of the areas where Democrats have a pretty thorough advantage. They've used money through Act Blue, which isn't disclosed sometimes, depending on the amount that's contributed. So that really could be foreign money and interference in our elections, honestly. But these Senate races are a real opportunity for us to identify candidates that are conservative and you know, resonate with the Republican primary voter. We got to get great conservative nominees right to the top of these competitive races and not allow the Washington swamp and the uniparty to select who's going to be representing us in these Senate races. So I do think that there was a lot of talk in 2022 about so-called candidate quality. But the bottom line is that candidate quality basically meant whether or not Mitch McConnell or Kevin McCarthy liked the candidate. And that's not what elections are about. Our oligarchs here in Washington don't get to select the candidates, even if they push tens of millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars around to try to affect that.
We are kicking off the new year here with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell folks a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We do federal advocacy on economic policies that expand economic growth, prosperity, and opportunity in America. We also have a political action committee that makes endorsements in federal races for the House and Senate. And if you want to learn more, check us out at clubforgrowth.org. You can actually join over 500,000 other Americans in becoming a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll look forward to talking with you throughout the year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Lincecum of the Cato Institute has written a new book entitled Empowering the American Worker, Market-Based Solutions for Today's Workforce. He talks about it with Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
The year is coming to an end, and 2022 will probably be remembered best perhaps for the fact that everything got more expensive this year. We had runaway inflation, but it's not just the economy. It's not just the grocery store where things got more expensive. It's been government policies that have contributed to the rising cost of just about everything this year. But we're going to take a look at how some changes in policy could maybe make those things a little better in 2023. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Scott Lincecum. He's the director of the Trade Policy Studies Project at the Cato Institute. And he's also the author and editor of a new book, Empowering the New American Worker. Scott, thanks for taking some time with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic new book. Really excited to get into it over the holiday break here. You cover a variety of topics in here, different ways in which everything from like the internet and deregulation can make people's lives better, can make workers' lives, you know, better, more free, more enjoyable. But one of the things that you touch on, kind of come back to repeatedly, is the ways in which government policies have like added to the costs that people, I don't think even really think about, right? Just like the commuting to work every day, childcare costs, these things that that are just always there.
The frustrating thing is that so often in Washington, you hear from the left and the right, it's one of the few things everybody can agree on, that American workers, particularly working families, are struggling to keep up, struggling to pay bills. And the immediate follow-up is that we need more government policy. We need more subsidies and mandates and all these sorts of government interventions to fix the problems facing American families and workers. Now, what they don't mention is just what you said. The laundry list of federal, state, and local laws and regulations that almost seemingly systematically raise the price of almost everything that a working family needs every day. You mentioned commuting. We have 25% tariffs on pickup trucks. We have regulations that increase the cost not only of automobiles, but of gasoline. And of course, we have all of these different Buy American rules and environmental regulations that make infrastructure and public transit more expensive too, and less available generally. But I think the one that really gets me is childcare, because again, most recently you see Republicans proposing big expansions in the child tax credit. Democrats want big childcare subsidies, and they always point to this ever-increasing price of childcare. And that's no doubt true. You know, in a place like Washington, D.C., childcare is almost 70% of a single parent's median income. I mean, so really, in other words, prohibitively expensive for a single mom to get formal childcare. But when you dig into that, you see that we have a bunch of regulations at the state level, things like staff to child ratios or occupational licensing rules or zoning restrictions that dramatically inflate the cost of childcare, not by a few bucks, but by thousands and thousands of dollars in these places. And so simple reforms, simple deregulatory reforms, and not total deregulation, but just simply tweaking those staff ratios or allowing people to take care of kids with merely a high school degree, heaven forbid, would mean a dramatic difference in the quality of life for a lot of working families.
One of the things in the book that you guys point out is that the share of high-income U.S. households has basically tripled since the 1960s. And I think that's one of these things that's worth pointing out, and because it's good news. And we don't hear this sort of thing that often. We think about the shrinking middle class as something that we hear a lot from the left. But and in some ways it's true. And in some ways 2022 is an outlier because everything did get more expensive and it's more difficult to make ends meet maybe. But like over the long term here, the middle class is shrinking because most of us are moving up.
Yeah, there's certainly a bit of caution that I start out the book, that a lot of the apocalyptic rhetoric you hear in D.C. and elsewhere, coming from, again, both left and the right these days, that the middle class is shrinking, that incomes have stagnated, well, a lot of that is just nonsense. I mean, so often you're going to hear, when you talk about pro-worker policy. The unstated assumption is that the free market has failed workers, right? That time and time again, market fundamentalism in Washington has really harmed the working class. But like I said, when you dig into it, you find that most of the time, you scratch a problem and you find a lot of bad government policy underneath.
We're talking with Scott Linscombe. He's the director of trade policy at the Cato Institute and the author and editor of a new book, Empowering the New American Worker is the title. Scott, not a whole lot of time left here, but you've touched on this once or twice here, but we hear these solutions or so-called solutions on both the left and the right of like, well, we need more subsidies to fix the, you know, the shrinking middle class, and we need more subsidies to convince people to have more kids so they can afford to pay for childcare, things like that. And instead, I mean, I think this book makes the pretty clear argument that like getting government out of the way kind of would be a subsidy in and of itself.
Oh, certainly when it comes to subsidizing demand without fixing all the supply side restrictions, right? When you look at so many areas of essential goods and services, whether it's education or housing or childcare or healthcare, if the government continues to subsidize demand like we do in a lot of these areas, while continuing to restrict supply via occupational licensing rules or other types of regulation and zoning and the rest, well, the inevitable result is going to be higher prices. And that might not be a big deal for folks at the top of the ladder, right, who have seen pretty impressive income gains and the rest. But the folks that are most hurt when you restrict access, when you have these higher prices, are going to be the American workers at the bottom of the scale. You know, folks that really are just struggling to get by living paycheck to paycheck, and especially larger families, right, that consume more of these goods and services. And that's the real problem here, that policies intended to help workers, intended to subsidize their living standards, can end up, when they run into that wall of supply restriction, actually making things worse for the vast majority of them.
I think the good intentions are really the thing that Congress is going for, not necessarily the outcomes and the results, unfortunately. So we'll probably see more of that from Washington. But it's great to see the alternative argument out there. And it's great to see people like you, Scott, making this argument for, as the book cover says, market-based solutions for today's workforce. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And again, that's Scott Linscombe. He's director of trade policy at the Cato Institute. And you can check out his new book, Empowering the New American Worker, Market-Based Solutions for Today's Workforce. Check out our coverage of everything going on in D.C. and around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Taxpayers in a number of states benefited from reformed tax policies enacted in 2022. To learn more, we turn to Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council. And this American Radio Journal Commentary.
As we are all thinking retrospectively now about 2022, it's important to consider how taxpayers fared, or as President Ronald Reagan would say, America's forgotten special interest group. While taxpayers took it on the chin in 2022 from Congress and the Biden administration and their myriad of bad economic policies, which led to, of course, the sky-high inflation and more tax increases we saw this year, the 50 laboratories of democracy once again led the way in free market approaches to governing. As in 2022 comes to a close now, it's important to recap some of the legislative victories that happened in the states this year. Let's start with the tax cuts, and boy, was it a great year for tax cutting in the states. By our count, 11 states substantially cut personal income taxes in 2022. Most notably, five of these states made historic changes from being progressive personal income tax states to going to a single rate flat personal income tax. Iowa kicked off this state flat tax revolution as Governor Kim Reynolds announced the passage of a $2 billion tax cut, the largest in state history, in her rebuttal to President Joe Biden's State of the Union address in March. Mississippi then followed suit soon after with a $525 million net tax cut, also the largest in their state history. As Mississippi Speaker of the House Philip Gunn noted, the Magnolia State's move to a flat tax is a bold first step on a clear path to continued elimination of the personal income tax altogether. The next state to join the flat tax revolution was Georgia, where lawmakers passed a $1 billion tax cut. In September, Idaho Governor Brad Little called the legislature into a special one-day session, which led to Idaho becoming the fifth state to join the flat tax revolution in 2022. And let's not forget about Arizona. where free market victories abounded in 2022. Arizona joined the flat tax revolution after a court decision earlier this year overturned their Proposition 208, which was passed by ballot measure in the year 2020 and added a huge surcharge to the highest income tax bracket. Thanks to the hard work of the Arizona legislature in 2021, the overturning of this surcharge means that Arizona will now have the lowest personal income tax rate in the nation at a flat rate of 2.5%. But the victories didn't stop there in Arizona. Over the summer, Arizona created the most universal education savings account program in the nation. Thanks to the state legislature's passage of HB 2853, every student and family in the state is poised to become eligible for this Empowerment Scholarship Account program, which was initially limited to students with special needs. 2022 also saw a rise in the push for environmental, social, and governance, or so-called ESG investing. Now, ESG investing is a huge threat to state pension plans, which are already severely underfunded by the trillions, as ALEC's annual report on unfunded state pension liabilities, unaccountable and unaffordable, shows annually. In this response to the growing politicalization of pension investment decisions, ALEC passed Model Policy, the State Government Employee Retirement Protection Act, to keep politics out of pensions. Senator Jim Runstead in Michigan introduced a bill to protect pension plans in the state of Michigan, and now numerous states are looking to follow suit and consider the ALEC proposal in 2023 to keep politics out of state pension systems. And while these states and many more were pursuing free market policies, big government states continued down the path of bad economic policy. In Massachusetts, voters recently approved a millionaire's tax in the name of increasing education funding. Massachusetts had been a 5% flat tax state, but now add an incredibly high 4% surcharge for those earning more than $1 million a year, creating a new top income tax rate of 9% and returning the Bay State to its former status of Taxachusetts. On the other side of the country, voters in the Golden State dodged a bullet as California's Proposition 30 failed on Election Day. Prop 30 would have pushed the Golden State's top personal income tax rate from 13.3, which is already the highest in America, to more than 15% for individuals making more than $2 million per year. Though this bullet may have been dodged this time around, Governor Gavin Newsom is still firing shots at any chance of economic prosperity and recovery in California. Recently, Governor Newsom proposed a so-called penalty on oil companies for their excess profits, quote-unquote. Don't be fooled. This is a tax. It simply calls it a penalty so he can circumvent the legislative requirement of a supermajority approval for tax increases in California. As states like California and Massachusetts continue their quest for bigger government, states like Iowa, Mississippi, Georgia, Idaho, Arizona, and many, many more will continue to lead the charge before free market, limited government approaches to problem solving in their states. And that is something we can all be very grateful for as we close out 2022. For more information, go to ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KYND-AM in Belleville, Texas, WLNX-FM in Lincoln, Illinois, along with WZZI-FM in Lynchburg, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.